Why lead a company into the increasingly crowded obesity space? How do you go from a career in veterinary surgery to CEO of a medtech company? And what is so magical about Oxford when it comes to life science? Welcome to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, where we explore the leadership journeys of life science entrepreneurs. I'm David Kirk, and in each episode, I sit down with a life science leader to uncover the moments that define their leadership. Today, I'm joined by Camilla Easter, CEO of Oxford Medical Products, or OMP, a late-stage medtech company based in Witney, Oxfordshire, in the UK. OMP's lead product is a non-pharmacological treatment for obesity in overweight patients. And we'll talk more about the science at the end of the episode, but firstly, Camilla, thanks for joining me on A Call to Lead.
A pleasure to be here. I can't wait.
I normally do like a little rundown of everybody's CV so they don't have to, but yours is one of my favorites, first of all, because you are coming from the veterinary medicine background, and you worked with one of my favorite animals, horses. I grew up in Kildare, horsey country. My aunt had a horse for show jumping and dressage, so I love horses. But it wasn't, funnily enough, it wasn't until I did my PhD in a veterinary medicine school. Now, I don't know anything about animals, but molecular biologist. But I learned that horses are so fragile.
Yeah, they do like to break quite a lot. That's true.
They're so strong. They're so fierce. They're so powerful. And they're so brittle.
Well, I think that's it. They are phenomenal creatures, but they've been bred ultimately to make human life better. And in doing so, as you said, very, very powerful, but they're at the top of their game. So they do get injured very easily.
And you moved from the veterinary space into Oxtex was the first company, and then into a leadership role with OMP, where you are now. Tell me about that journey. Maybe we start from the beginning with the big question. What called you to lead? What was that catalyst for leadership throughout your life?
I think it actually stems from before veterinary. I think if you're able to say, I think it was somewhat innate within me. I think it's been a very nice process to sort of go through some of the questions we were going to discuss today and have a reflective period. And I sort of thought, oh, I'll go back before veterinary. And actually, I was leading kind of innately at school. I think even, you know, as early as sort of junior school, I'm one of three girls. I'm the youngest. We're very loud. We're all very opinionated. And it wasn't until I went to boarding school when I was eight that I really started to get this sense of self, of who I am, what are my opinions. And I was able to sort of throw myself into that school life and just thoroughly enjoyed being involved in everything and really loved being on the sports teams and the drama and the academic. And then that naturally, I think, you start to lead in some of those, you know, be it captain of a sports team or lead in a play at school. And I just always thoroughly enjoyed that. And that went through into senior school again. And I think this sort of comes into leadership as well. I was very involved in all of school life. So I was on the sports teams, the debate teams, music, drama. I wasn't really the top of anything. I got something called an all-round scholarship because I did everything. I loved everything. I was pretty good at everything, but not the best by any means. But I think what that meant was I had a really good sense of what made lots of different people tick, the art scholars, the sports scholars, the drama scholars, because I was involved in all of that. So I actually ended up being head girl of that school. And I think that was my first real experience of leading a community that I was already been part of for several years. And I was able to, you know, make real change because I'd worked alongside these people. I'd loved that holistic approach and throwing ourselves into everything. You don't have to be the best. You sort of have to love everything and understand what makes people tick who are brilliant in those fields. So I think that call to lead happened much earlier than perhaps, you know, going into veterinary or even going into biotech.
Tell me about what brought you into the veterinary space. I know from working with vets over the years, you can be quite independent as a veterinary surgeon. Was that part of the appeal?
No, actually, I don't think it necessarily was that appeal. I think fundamentally, it was maybe a little bit more naive than that. When you were at school and everyone asks you, what are you going to do? What career are you going to do? I sort of thought fairly narrow. I think I thought, well, I love veterinary. Oh, sorry. Well, I love science and I grew up with animals a bit like you, surrounded by horses, dogs, cats. And it was just a big part of my life. And I really enjoyed that. So it was a very obvious career choice for someone who was pretty academic, loved the sciences, loved problem solving, and also equally, you know, really enjoy spending time with animals. And so I loved that side of things and went into veterinary. But I think actually you're right. It can be quite independent, particularly equine veterinary. So I love my undergraduate because, again, you're in this fantastic community at vet school. You know it. You've been there. You're embedded in it. And it's very all-encompassing veterinary undergraduate. You know, speaking to peers now that did more traditional degrees at university, they had lots of spare time and time to read and do other things. You know, we didn't have that. The course was 9 to 5 every single day. And so you're in this little bubble of all your other vets, and it's actually a great community to be in because you're all working towards the same thing. You've really got similar outlooks from that point of view. But it also probably stops you being adventurous in other areas and understanding what else is possible with this sort of background and this sort of training. So I was on that path and I, you know, qualified as a vet and I always wanted to go into equine. So I got a fantastic training position in equine. And I was so busy being the best I could be, being the best vet I could be, that it wasn't until I sort of came out of that training position, and that was like an 18-month position, which was amazing, but such hard work. You didn't leave the hospital. I had 1.5 days off every other week. And so you didn't really do anything else. All your friends were vets. And it was as I came out of that program, that training position, I kind of stepped back and thought, well, what next? And I realized that there was this big conflict, actually, between my desire to be the best vet I could possibly be and throw myself into that. But again, sort of harping back to my sort of earlier education, that desire to lead and change and build, I couldn't necessarily see with the veterinary profession, which has changed a lot, you know, over the last few decades, I couldn't see an easy route through that I could enjoy the profession and lead at the same time, certainly in the way that I wanted to. And that was, you know, one of those big wake-up calls. And it was then that I started really exploring other career opportunities and how I ultimately ended up at Oxtec, that first medtech, biotech.
Yeah. And there was a couple of transition points really there, that transition away from the veterinary life into Oxtec, but then your transition into a leadership role with OMP. Can you tell me about those moments and what was that entrepreneurial call to lead for you?
So I think I was incredibly fortunate with that first job and everybody I was surrounded by at the time. I was recruited by another medic. So he had been doing his registrar. He'd gone to the university at Oxford. He'd spun out a company. So he understood what I was going through on that transition. So it was, you know, a fantastic coach and mentor. And more widely within the company, there were other medics and others that had gone through a similar career transition. So that was really, really helpful for me. I spent 5 years at that company. You know, I was the fourth employee of the company. It was just amazing, this exposure to this fast-paced environment I had never really experienced in the same way before. And essentially the amount of opportunities that you were able to have and run with ideas and problem solve at your own speed as fast as you can, essentially, that I never really experienced in veterinary. So within months of being within that role, I was somewhat relieved, but also very excited that I'd absolutely found where I wanted to build my career and essentially spend the rest of my professional life in this industry. So I spent 5 years there. I think that call to lead, I was allowed to develop those skills within that job. So, you know, I started off as almost an all-round, as it were. You know, I did the preclinical, I helped establish the quality management system, and then I started fundraising. And I ended up as the chief operating officer there for my last couple of years. And so that development and that sort of coaching that I had within the company really set me up very nicely, that after 5 years at that company, I thought, you know, I had some personal things, it was a great time for me to go and reflect. I thought, you know, now is the time that I really want to find my next journey and start something really right from the beginning and grow something phenomenal within this space.
In your transition from Oxtec to OMP, was there a different change in your thinking that you wanted to lead a venture?
I think so. I think, again, it comes back to this. It had always been on my radar. I think I learned a huge amount at Oxtex, but I also learned what didn't work. And I think that's really important as well, to see things that are working, but, you know, say, well, if I had my time again and I was leading this, perhaps I would have done things slightly differently. And it's quite nice to be in that position, because it's very easy when you're not leading to make those sort of assumptions. But I felt like I was ready for that step change. And I really always enjoyed that early phase of looking at the tech, evaluating the tech, building that early core team, bringing on those investors with you. It's just one of the most exciting times.
Yeah. Now, what personal challenges or obstacles did you have to face and make key decisions on throughout your leadership journey?
So I think, you know, as I said, when I spent the 5 years at Oxtex, it wasn't just that, you know, I'd spent those 5 years, it actually came a sort of point where I had to start deciding what was I going to do on my next journey. And I'd had my first child while I was at Oxtex, and that had been, you know, an interest. You know, it's quite hard, isn't it, transitioning through your first child, and particularly professionally. I'd taken very little maternity leave with that child because I was so keen to get back into a job I absolutely loved, to be honest. And then I was pregnant with my second, so I had a two-year-old at home, pregnant with second. My father died very suddenly and fairly young, actually. And it was a sort of quite, you know, very, very big wake-up call for me, because no one expects that to happen. It was very rapid. And I then went on a few months later to have my second child. And I thought, actually, I need to spend a bit of time, and this is a great opportunity. I'll take a bit of a longer maternity leave this time. My husband was working crazy hours, so I thought, I'll just take a bit longer and work out what are my next steps. But I knew that at that point that there was another path I was going to go on. But perhaps it was more traditional. Perhaps I would take a more traditional role in another company. But I guess every time I looked at the roles, I kept thinking, no, just that isn't for me. I really want to do something myself. So instead, essentially, I ended up doing some consultancy work, which fitted in very nicely. And it was whilst doing that consultancy work that I came across the tech at OMP, or what was to become essentially OMP, and was asked to come on and evaluate it. So that was really the journey. I'd never thought I'm absolutely right now going to do it. In fact, I thought the timing's pretty bad. You know, I have a 6-month-old, I have a 2-year-old, I have a husband who's not around much because he's just so busy. But ultimately, this is what I want to do. And so it was when this opportunity presented itself at OMP, and I realized just how amazing that founding team was. And I've been working with quite a few companies, and it just both the founding team and the technology was so far ahead of anything else I'd seen. I just thought, I have to do this. This isn't really a choice now. If I don't do this, I will regret it for the rest of my life. So for me, it was ultimately actually an easy decision, but it just the timing, like anything, is it's rarely perfect, is it?
Yeah. Well, I think that challenge you've described is so universal. It's so human. I mean, your husband, I know, is also in the veterinary space, and we've just talked about how busy that is in terms of workload. And of course, having children, and again, our parents passing, it's a very emotional time. I'd love to know, what were you reflecting on during that period? What was kind of going through your head?
I think, you know, like everyone, your parents play a big part in your life. And my father had actually also been an entrepreneur. So he had a sort of essentially a API business where he'd import different chemicals from different companies, particularly for pharmaceuticals back in the day. And he'd been a big part of my transition actually from veterinary. So when I left veterinary, or was contemplating leaving veterinary, I had quite a lot of resistance from my peers and some family members who said, oh, you're throwing away 5 years of education. Why are you throwing away your career? And they didn't get it, because why would they? No one else has been in my shoes, but he was able to really support me through that transition and told me some stories about when he had left his industry. He'd worked in Big Pharma and then set up his own company. And actually, I learned things from him at that point that I had never learned. You know, things like when he set up his company, his backers pulled out and he'd already left his job. And, you know, he had to go and find, they ended up basically remortgaging and put everything online. I never knew that as a child. I never felt that. Of course, we weren't exposed to it. But he really understood the risk, but also the drive and the thrill of setting up these companies and doing that. So I think part of that reflection was, well, he did it and he believed and was very successful. I believed I could do it as well. I believed I had something to give. I believed I could build something very, very big, which I was never going to do if I went into a more traditional role. And so I think it is about timing, but it's having that space to think about it.
I didn't know that at all. Oh, wow. It's interesting how our parents do shape our journeys in sometimes subtle and not so subtle ways, but interesting as well that he shared some very specific challenges with you as you were going through your own, and it kind of leads me on nicely to what I'd like to ask you next. You're based down in Oxford, big science hub generally. You must get to see quite a few of your peers. What do you think are the biggest shared challenges you have with other life science leaders today?
So I think a lot of us are facing the same challenges around financing. The markets have not been fantastic this year, perhaps certainly the private markets. And I know a lot of individuals and a lot of companies who have been struggling to raise. So I think we're able to share that. And I think that's very, very helpful to understand that a lot of people are going through the same processes. What are they doing? How are they communicating that with their teams? How are they managing their budgets and prioritizing their pipelines? So that's super helpful. Everyone's very open and everyone's very supportive. I think more locally, we'll often talk about talent. So, you know, where are we finding our talent from? How are we reimbursing? How are we structuring that? So that you're able to have a conversation with others really in the same ecosystem, the same environment, and learn from their learnings as well. So, you know, Oxford is a phenomenal place to be. It just gets, you know, better and better with the Ellison Institute going up just down the road from me. It's just a fantastic place to be. And I think that in itself brings more leaders to it, which is just great for all of us to learn from.
On that point of talent, I think a lot of people go through recruiters. They go through a very standard way of finding and onboarding people. But do you have any interesting talent finding stories yourself?
So we do that. There's no question about it. We will use recruiters where appropriate, but we do absolutely leverage our own networks, of course. So constantly speaking to people who sort of say, I'm looking for this sort of role. Do you know anybody? So I will approach those more, you know, traditional routes around recruiters, but also really lean on the ecosystem, particularly if you're looking for something quite niche and someone very special.
So taking those tidbits of knowledge from the people in your ecosystem, your peers, I'd love to know, is there anything valuable that you have learned from peers or colleagues or mentors that you could not possibly have learned through your formal education?
Yeah, I mean, of course, absolutely loads. I think the two major areas that have probably stood me in very good stead are, and I watch and I'm always in awe of people that do this very well, but I think communicating very, very well makes everything so much easier and you're so much more likely to be successful. And conversely, you can be the best surgeon or you could have the best tech in the world, but if you are unable to communicate with your stakeholders about the risks, about the upside, about the opportunity, you will never get, you know, the full potential out of that endeavor. So I think being able to communicate very, very well is key. But I think it's sort of deeper than that. It's quite easy to communicate when things are going well. It's very exciting. Everyone's on your side. But I think the most important time to communicate is quickly and appropriately when things are not going well, when you have a failed experiment or a failed trial or something along those lines, and that you make sure everybody's on board and you explain the plan, what happened, what you've learned from that, and how you're going to move forward. And sometimes that's actually quite hard to do. And it's just so important that you do that well and you do that in a timely manner. And I think the other aspect is, you know, speak to people, ask questions. This is a great organization, you know, lifescience.org. People want to help. And so many people have got such great learnings already. They've been through these problems. You don't need to reinvent solutions that other people probably have already been through and they can advise you on. We're talking about ecosystems and Oxford's fantastic, but even within Oxford, you get, you know, the clusters. And so we are clustered around the medtech, so we can see Abbott pretty much from our offices, and Owen Mumford are doing huge expansion around us. And they also are very collaborative. You're able to go and speak to them and say, you know, we're looking at putting in a big line. Who do you use as your external automation companies? Can we come and look around? They could not be more helpful. It's being part of that environment, asking questions, asking for help, asking for solutions, that you're going to get there so much more quickly.
Yeah, it's, and again, this sense of community that you can lean on people in times of trouble. And that the point about communication as well, I think it kind of touches nicely back to what you said about financing. We're going through a hard time in the industry generally, and being able to communicate that to people is so important. Before we talk about OMP and everything you're doing there, I'd like to know, being on this side of the pond, what do you find particularly exciting or inspiring about European life sciences today?
I mean, I think we've just touched a little bit on it. It's a very exciting time. We have, for me, we've got the Ellison Institute literally just up the road from where I live. So I was driving past the other day, there must be like a dozen cranes up building the most phenomenal lab space, huge investment into our ecosystem. But that investment hasn't just, happened. It's happened because we are a great environment. Europe is a phenomenal place for science and for life science companies. And so to be able to attract fantastic investment and opportunity is very, very exciting for the sector. And I think we massively outpunch, our weight on science and fantastic early companies. And now we just have to say, well, we have it. We have the core. We have the startups. We need to build them and keep them here. So the opportunity is fantastic, but we have to really grasp that now and own that.
And we'll talk a little bit about the ecosystem in a minute, but as a leader, you have chosen to address obesity and weight management. Very popular in the last few years. We've seen Wegovy and Mounjaro and these GLP ones. Yes.
Yep.
I'm remembering that right. Tell me about the challenge in that space and what it means for patients. And more importantly, why did you as a leader choose to pursue this?
So I think that goes back to that transition, me looking at different tech. And it wasn't specifically obesity at the time, and we can come on to that. But actually, when I was presented with the technology that the founding team had made, and we sort of said, well, here's the problem is we have 1 billion people in the world who are obese. We have 2 billion people in the world who are overweight. And actually, this is back in 2019. We have very few treatment options. So at the time, gold standard treatment option was surgery. Of course, surgery, whilst very effective on an individual level, and it does work very well for treatment of obesity, it's not scalable. You cannot treat billions of people with surgery. And so for me, that was one of the first points where I sort of stood back and went, Sat. We know, and we knew back then that obesity was a problem. We have, in the UK, we've had like 700 policies over the last 20, 25 years on diet, exercise, education. And despite those 700 policies, our BMI rates have just been going higher and higher. So it doesn't work. For whatever reason, education, diet and exercise is not working. We can't operate on this problem. It's not a problem that can be fixed by surgeons or on a sort of societal scale. So the problem was huge. And I was sort of even more amazed when I really started to look back at this problem. And I stood back and I thought, we all know this is a problem. But actually what I hadn't necessarily really got to grips with and appreciated is that we've been treating all of these comorbidities of obesity for years, and we've been pouring billions and billions of research money into treating type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease and infertility and osteoarthritis and cancer. And we can go on and on and on, because obesity is one of the leading factors in all of those diseases. I mean, type 2 diabetes is the obvious one. It's 90% of type 2 diabetes is caused by excessive weight. And so I thought, why are we not pouring more into treating that underlying disease of obesity? I think part of the problem was there was no good solution at that time. The other part of the problem was the stigma involved, particularly back then. And it's getting so much better now. But even when I got going and started fundraising, in the early days, we'd be going out to angels. I would often get feedback, but why can't people just move more and eat less? And he thought, gosh, but really, that's like banging your head against a brick wall, because we've been trying to do that with the 700 policies for the last 20 years. This is not a benign disease. Okay, it doesn't matter about the aesthetics. This is causing so many other comorbidities that, quite frankly, as society, we are duty bound. And as life science entrepreneurs and researchers, we're duty bound to find a solution for this, because if we can start treating this effectively, we can actually prevent all of these other diseases, not even just treat them, we can prevent them all. So it goes back to this when I said, I have to do this. I had to do this. The problem was just enormous. You know, I consider myself a relatively educated person, but I'd never, although I knew the links, I'd never really sat back and thought about the size of this problem, the size of impact if you could solve this problem. And so for me, that coupled with the fact that the technology, you know, blew me away. So just, I guess, for the listeners, to give them a bit of background, what we've developed is something called a copolymer hydrogel therapy. So this is essentially, it looks like a pill, comes in a blister pack. You swallow the pill. It swells rapidly in your stomach to around about the size of a golf ball. So it's a soft, round sponge, essentially. And what that does is it reduces the available volume in your stomach, very much like surgery does, like gastric balloons or bands and things like that. And so it reduces the available volume so that you feel full, you eat less, and ultimately you lose weight. So this is a very tried and tested mode of action already. The problem being that all of the other technologies are very invasive. So you have to have the balloon placed in hospital, it then passes, you have to have an x-ray shirt in the right place, obviously surgery. And so what we wanted to do was create something that could be prescribed by primary care, that could be taken at home, was very, very safe, and could be scaled. So that's really important as well. That was sort of the last part of that, was there's no point in producing something that's going to be too expensive for public healthcare settings to reimburse, particularly when we're trying to treat something on this magnitude. And so when I was able to see those feasibility studies that we did early on, I could see how effective and what the potential of this technology was, coupled with the size of the problem, it was a no-brainer. This had to happen. We have to get this technology out there to everybody.
It's a fascinating technology, and I think an elegant solution in many ways, the way you've described it. It's circumventing the surgical option. And a follow-up question to this I want to ask you is, and it kind of goes back to what we were talking about, the ecosystem. But in the larger life science ecosystem, we have regulators, scientists, investors, pharma companies as well. What can we do as an ecosystem to help address these challenges in obesity and weight management?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've made a huge progress just in the last sort of 5 years. We have these phenomenal companies, you know, Lilly and Novo, and now Pfizer and Roche all coming through, you know, AstraZeneca, all of them have got fantastic assets, either commercial or in development. And that in itself is really starting to change the narrative. So as I said, back in 2019, there was a lot of stigma and a lack of understanding about the disease. In fact, a lot of people wouldn't have considered it a disease. They considered it a lifestyle choice. They couldn't be more wrong. When you start to really understand the disease process and its complexity, that it, you know, has to be treated to prevent all of these other comorbidities. So a lot of the work has been done by these fantastic big pharma giants. But what it's also done is made people realize we can treat this disease, and B, actually, we have to treat this disease. I think we've seen both individuals and society and public healthcare systems really wake up and go, if we don't solve this problem, which is arguably the biggest health crisis facing the world right now, we are all further down the line going to be so much worse off, both individual health, societal health, productivity, the burden on those healthcare systems because of having to treat all of those diseases that come as a result of living with excessive weight. And so I think as an ecosystem, we all have to lean into that. We have to provide multiple treatment options. We've got some great assets out there with the drugs. We shouldn't forget surgery. It's still a very valid, useful treatment option for certain individuals. But actually what we need is polypharmacy. So we need lots of different options. And I include, even though we're regulated as a device, I include Sirona and polypharmacy because actually we look and feel like a pill. And that allows people choice and it allows people option, because when you've got a disease that's, you know, affecting 3 billion people, they all have different needs and requirements. It's not a simple silver bullet. This is going to work for everyone. We know that's not true. We know some people can't tolerate the GLP-1s. People can't afford the GLP-1s at the moment. So we have lots of different angles we need to fix. We need to look at pricing, accessibility. We need to look at tolerability. We need to look at the right treatment options for the right people. And I think that's where Sirona really starts to come into its own, because at the moment we have lots and lots, hundreds of assets in development for obesity, particularly in this incretin hormone space. So you'll have heard of amylin, obviously you've heard of the GLP-1s, et cetera. So there's quite a lot of different gut hormones that are being looked at the moment. The lovely thing about Sirona is because we're totally mechanical in action, we can be used in polypharmacy across all of these drugs and complementary. So for instance, our early data suggests that we work very well in sort of lower classes of obesity. So class one obesity, for instance, we saw fantastic weight loss in those individuals. So they have a different disease profile and therefore potentially different treatment needs to somebody with a BMI of plus 50, for instance. And we have to be able to adapt to those individuals. And Sirona can be used in lots of different ways. So it can be used in early intervention because we've got a phenomenal side effect profile compared to the GLP-1s. It can be used in combination therapy. So it might be you can tolerate the GLP-1s to a certain dose. I'm sure you'll have heard of this. A lot of people dose escalate. They can't tolerate the top doses. Actually, we can add in a Sirona as a complementary sort of compound effect because it's working in a completely different way. So you get a really nice synergistic effect. Or if in fact, we can be used, you know, I get emails daily, as you can imagine, for people wanting to come onto Sirona. And one of the most common emails I get is, I'm on Ozempic or I'm on Mounjaro. I've lost my weight, I'm maintaining, but I don't want to have to keep suffering the side effects and I don't want to continue on these drugs forever, but I know my weight is going to come back on. Can I transition on to something like Sirona? And that would be a fantastic use case for our sort of technology. And I think the other thing that we also have to, and I don't think the media is quite there yet in the way we look at obesity, it is a chronic disease and we have to treat it long term. So I still get this question now, which is, oh, but when people stop taking your treatment, will the weight come back on? Well, yes, for a lot of people it will. And that's true of all of our obesity and overweight therapies, because if you stop treating the disease, if you stop treating blood pressure, your blood pressure will come back. Well, if you stop treating obesity, it's a progressive chronic disease. If you stop treating it, appetite will come back and weight will come back on. So we need to also make sure that everyone's able to understand the disease process and why continued treatment is necessary. But it's the environment's changing rapidly and absolutely for the better. And I think we need to bring on public healthcare systems. I think they need to be more proactive in reimbursing these treatments. I know it's very, very costly, but the health economics speak for themselves. If we are able to treat and ultimately prevent obesity, all of the resources that we were pouring into those chronic diseases can be diverted elsewhere for, you know, other disease processes or other areas to improve, you know, everybody's life. So it's incredibly important that the whole of society embraces what is essentially a massive leap in technology and longevity, actually, for the human race.
You've outlined the scale of the challenge, I think, very compellingly, very passionately as well. I would like you to paint a positive vision of the future for me. What does the world look like when you're successful?
I mean, phenomenally different how it looks today. I think the best way to probably think of this is, you know, we can't remember it, but I think we can understand and empathize with it. We remember a time before sanitation and then ultimately a time before antibiotics. We couldn't have surgery. Before sanitation, everybody was dying of gastrointestinal diseases, from infection, from bacterial diseases. That's going to be the size of the change we're going to see with these obesity treatments. It's going to be akin to antibiotics coming along. It's going to be akin to understanding sanitation or vaccines, for instance. That is the magnitude of being able to treat and prevent obesity, because ultimately, we've talked about treating obesity, but there's no need for anybody to ever actually become obese. We should be intervening much, much earlier so that 90% of all type 2 diabetes fails to ever exist. We can eradicate the vast majority of type 2 diabetes, the same for cardiovascular disease, the same for many cancers, for infertility. And so the impact of effectively treating and preventing obesity is so far reaching. And we've just discussed the comorbidities, but there's the productivity, this increased quality of life. There's it's just throughout the whole of our society and throughout our whole lives. The size and the impact of this, as I said, is akin to one of our big changes in medicine.
And for patients as well, that quality of life change must be amazing. You're able to do so much more.
That's it, isn't it? That's the baseline. That is understanding. I actually think in sort of 30 or 40, maybe 50 years time, it will be like it is today. If you get an infection or something like that, you just take antibiotics. You don't even think about it. You have to really go and reflect to think, what if I had this infection, I couldn't treat it? It will sort of be the same. People won't necessarily understand. They won't know about half of these chronic diseases or certainly appreciate what would happen if they were widespread throughout society, because hopefully they won't be experiencing it because we won't be having it.
Finally, our podcast is a call to lead, and I want to thank you for sharing your story, your passion as well with me. But the last thing I want to end on is there anything on your leadership journey or on the leadership journey generally that we haven't talked about that you'd like to spend your last few minutes on?
I think one thing that probably isn't always discussed around leadership and building is failure, actually, and how hard it can sometimes be. Again, it comes back to these difficult questions we don't always like to communicate. But I think it's so important that we do communicate failure, and we talk about it very openly. And I think we talked about the great opportunity in Europe at the moment. It's perhaps one of the biggest learnings, I think, culturally from Europe, and a big difference between the US and Europe, is that we don't necessarily celebrate failure or embrace it as a learning in the way that they do. And perhaps that's reflected in some of the success stories. We don't see as many serial entrepreneurs in Europe as we do in the US. So I think we should talk more openly about it. We should remove the stigma. We know if we remove stigma, everything largely gets better. We get better funding and better understanding. So I think we should remove the stigma around failure. We should be honest about how hard it can be. It's not all roses. Sometimes it's very, very hard work. And make sure that people who want to lead and are starting their journey see both sides. It is just the most amazing career, and it's just unbelievably fulfilling, but it's also very, very hard at times. And so I think if you go into that without understanding that you're going to have those hard times, it's going to come as quite a shock to the individual when that happens. So I think we should talk about that more openly.
I like that phrase, that kind of removes failure from the equation. You either succeed or you learn.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Camilla, for joining me on A Call to Lead. I hope your stories, your insights will resonate with our audience.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for having me, Dave.
It's no secret that Europe is a global leader in generating translational science. We're grateful at LifeScience.org to have a community of over 400 life science CEOs, leaders driving change in biotech, medtech, tech bio, and healthcare. The conversations inside our community, stories of conviction, navigating challenges, and making bold decisions, inspire us every week. To hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of our life science leaders, listen to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, available on all good podcasting platforms.